This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
What is the difference between mere life and the good life? Aristotle once said, "The good life is a life informed by the principles that express our highest ideals, life as we would like to live it."
The good life is an education that rattles and decenters.
Relationships, sustenance, and aspirations.
A life of reflection and agency in concert with others in pursuit of collective well-being.
The good life needs to equate instead with a healthier public life.
Pursuing knowledge, cultivating friendship, preserving freedom, satisfying needs.
The good life is having a language to express your deepest thoughts, emotion, and belief.
The good life is when students' eyes light up at the realization that their engineering work will improve other people's lives.
Stay with us as some of UC San Diego's finest scholars share their pursuit of the good life.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. My name is Steve Cassidy. I'm a professor in the literature department. I'm an associate dean of graduate studies. I used to be the director of the Making of the Modern World program, and I am a founder of this lecture series. My co-founder is tonight's speaker. Welcome and welcome back to UCSD and to this lecture series. It's so great to see so many familiar faces out there. Alan Houston and I continue to rub our eyes and pinch ourselves over the success of this series. The first year we ran it a couple of years ago, we were sold out in about 2 days. We were just astonished. But I feel safe in saying this tonight because I'm not the speaker. I think it's owing to all of you guys and to our astonishingly wonderful faculty here at UCSD. Thank you. Each year's series has a theme. The first year we called it To Be Human. Last year it was To Be Musical. This year it's The Good Life. And, okay, let's face it, we go out and we find really, really outstanding faculty members. We tell them to talk about this theme, and we give them almost complete freedom to speak about whatever they choose. Tonight, we are lucky enough to have Alan Houston. Alan Houston joined the faculty at UCSD in the Department of Political Science in 1989. He has recently served as provost of Eleanor Roosevelt College. As I mentioned, he's my co-organizer of this lecture series. And this year, he is serving as interim vice chancellor for student affairs. I think it's probably safe to say that if he is not the world's top authority on Ben Franklin, he's one of a tiny handful. He has devoted much of his professional academic career to writing about the early United States and the late colonial period, in addition to Restoration England, and has written a number of books on those topics. Tonight, he will be speaking, as I mentioned before, on Ben Franklin and the good life. He will speak for about 40 or 50 minutes. After that, we will have questions. I'll ask those who wish to ask questions to come forward to the microphone, and then we will try to wrap up by 7:30. Please join me in welcoming to the podium Professor Alan Houston.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you all for coming tonight. I find myself actually struggling a bit for words, and not for all the usual reasons. For the last 2 years, each night in this series, as it has opened, I have said that our purpose is to present some of the university's finest professors, teachers, scholars, and artists. In the present context, that might seem immodest. But someone needs to say it. so I will say it. Ordinarily, when people, after I make this introduction and people come on a stage, they do things like thank the organizers for the series for inviting them to be a part of it. I have the same problem again. So instead, I will simply say thank you all. I agree completely with Steve. The only reason this series succeeds is because you are here, because the strength of the audience interest is matched by the skill and talent of the faculty in this university, and our goal is to have an intellectually engaging evening. For the last 2 years, we have done so in style. I am confident that this year, every speaker will have that effect on you. I hope, I pray, I wish that I can meet that standard, but it is a very high standard. So I do want to tell you as well, right off the bat, that my talk is rather short, very short. Franklin would approve, of course, because he hated waste. He hated wasting time above all else. Remember, he said, time is money. And those who waste time might as well be squandering and wasting money. Okay, so let's be honest and think about this. You already know the answer to this entire lecture. You know the theme and topic to it. What is the relationship between Benjamin Franklin and the American dream? How many of you have one of these? Show of hands. How many of you want to have one of these? We're done. Talk's done. Okay, maybe that's a little too quick. Let me try one more time. Franklin was born in 1706 in the city of Boston. He died in 1790 in the city of Philadelphia. He was famous for many, many things. He was a scientist. You know him well as a man who flew kites in a thunderstorm. He was a politician of extraordinary skill and accomplishment who helped to write the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of 1787. Perhaps most importantly in this context, he was a writer of tremendous skill and subtlety, perhaps one of the three or four finest English stylists in the 18th century, most famous in the United States for being the author of Poor Richard's Almanac, with those famous phrases that some of you may have been raised on: time is money, or a penny saved is a penny got, or most famously, early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. You all know exactly what I'm talking about. And what of the American dream? The American dream is a simple idea. It is the idea that every citizen of the United States should have an equal opportunity to achieve success and prosperity through hard work, through determination, and through initiative and industry. The basic form of the American dream is simply this: if you work hard and play by the rules, you will gain success. The cornerstone of the American dream is the belief that power and privilege should be the fruit of individual effort and industry and not something ascribed on the basis of your heritage, your history, your identity, your ethnicity, or your sex. I've taught the American dream and Franklin to undergraduates on a number of occasions, and I did make the mistake once early on. The basic form of the American dream is that if you work hard and you play by the rules, what do you get? Sex. That's what I said. And all 200 UCSD undergraduates adored me for the rest of the quarter. But this is a powerful American narrative. It is a powerful part of the identity of the United States. Bill Clinton in 1993 put it clearly: the American dream that we were all raised on is a simple but powerful one. If you work hard and you play by the rules, you should be given a chance to go as far as your God-given ability will take you. It is not without its critics. The comedian George Carlin once mordantly quipped, "The reason they call it the American dream is because you have to be asleep to believe it." But it has a tremendous hold on American public opinion. In this country, the vast majority, perhaps two-thirds of all citizens, rich and poor, prosperous and not, all believe that through dint of effort and industry, they can succeed. They can get ahead. The degree to which this belief is held by Americans exceeds that of any other country in the world. And once again, we know the symbol of what people mean when they say success. Franklin is the embodiment of the ideal. He is the avatar of the ideal that success is achieved through money. The ceaseless pursuit of money, of more and more money. Do you understand the logic here? I'm telling you what I want to refute in the rest of this lecture. This is a strong and central piece to the American narrative. It is how he gets on the $100 bill. It is what makes this a powerful connection in the American mind and in popular culture. And you might say we could all go home. I've already forecast. I don't think we should. I think there's more to it. But we want to try and understand, what more can you say about the American dream and about Benjamin Franklin? How can we understand his conception of the good life? If it's not making money, what is it? What should we do with our lives? How should we spend our time and energy? Franklin, of course, we know quite well. He did not practice what he preached. He was a hypocrite, let's say it. He preached hard work, but at the age of 42 in 1748, he retired. What a delicious life. After he retired, what did he do? He continued to pursue scientific research. He made extraordinary and original discoveries in electricity, in atmospheric science, in population studies, and the early science of demography. He was an extraordinarily active civic leader. He formed in Philadelphia a volunteer fire department, a charity hospital. He helped to lead the colonies in the early stages of the Seven Years' War. This actually is the first political cartoon in American history. It was written, designed, and printed by Franklin in 1754 at the beginning of the Seven Years' War. It was an attempt to try and capture in graphic form the importance of unity. And I'll come back to this repeatedly because it was a theme that was central to him, that we must work together to achieve things that are worthy of humans. In this case, the colonies must work together, or like a snake severed into distinct pieces, they will die. Not all of his life was spent working, after all, either. He was an avid chess player. It turns out that throughout his life, he was intensely devoted to the art of chess. He traveled, he played, he studied books. Intriguingly, if you read his letters, the most common correspondents with whom he speaks about chess are women. It provided an intellectually engaging social setting in which he could share and talk and think and engage in political and social and artistic discussion. This is a small chess set that he gave to a friend of his, a young woman, and it's a traveling set, chess set. It's actually, the pieces are about 3/4 of an inch tall. They all fit inside this little silver egg. The board rolls up, and you can pack it and take it with you. He's a man who delighted in inventing things, inventing musical instruments. This is a glass harmonica. Has anyone ever seen or heard a glass harmonica? The inspiration is we've all had, sitting with a glass of wine and rubbing your fingers around the top. And you think at that moment that it would be lovely if you had it in multiples, you know, in scales and octaves. And so Franklin figured out how to turn the glasses on their side, mount them on a spindle, have them rotate in a little bed of water, and then you could play it with your fingers. To be honest, if you listen to it today, I'm not quite sure what the right word would be, but deathly and frightening and somewhere in the neighborhood of fingernails on a blackboard. But it was tremendously popular in the 18th century. Mozart, Beethoven, Richard Strauss, they all wrote major pieces of music to be performed on this instrument that Franklin himself designed. He enjoyed, of course, life. He enjoyed the fruit of the vine. This is one of his more... He also had a wicked sense of humor. And this is one of his humorous jests. You'll recall and many times people have attempted to demonstrate the existence of God by appealing to what's called an argument from design. You know that God exists because it would take a designer to make something as sophisticated and complicated as a human hand, as a human eye. A watch is an extraordinarily complex device. We know wherever there is a watch, there must have been a watchmaker. So people concluded, looking at the sophistication and complexity of the human body, of the world around us, the eye of a fly, the wing of a bird, we know that there must be a designer who was responsible for that. Everything has its purpose, and every purpose has a thing. Franklin wondered. So that's why some animals have long necks so that they can drink from the water. And this is part of the design. Now, what do we know about humans? They have elbows. And what does the elbow tell us about God's intentions for us? Well, if the elbow had been put down low, you would never be able to get a glass to your mouth. And if the elbow had been put up high, you could never have gotten the glass up to your mouth. But because the elbow is right there, it is clear that the deity intended us to drink wine on a regular basis. And of course, he loved to flirt, especially with the women of Paris. This is, he wrote to a friend in 1779, "This is the most civil nation upon earth." He's in Paris at the time. He had been sent in 1776 as the minister of the United States trying to negotiate money, trying to get the King of France to give funds so that the American colonies, the newly independent United States, could pay for the material needed to fight a war against Great Britain. In Paris, he wrote, "This is the most civil nation on earth. Someone, it seems," I like the tone, "someone, it seems, gave it out that I loved ladies. And then everyone presented their ladies to me, or the ladies presented themselves, and they wanted to be embraced, that is, to have their necks kissed. Oh, this is a delightful people to be with." This doesn't sound like a man who spends all his time and effort and energy on making money. Money is not his goal or objective, but what is it? What can we say? We could just say he's a hypocrite and let it be at that and pass. Or we could say, perhaps we've underestimated, we've been misguided. The $100 bill and all of the other symbols and trappings that associate Franklin with the saving and making and money, the penny saved as penny earned logic, has led us to misunderstand what Franklin is about and to misunderstand also what the American dream is about, or what one version of that dream might be like. That's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to give you a new taste of who this person was and what he sought to achieve, and try and cultivate a sense of what he thought the good life should be. So we want to talk about first improving life. Franklin, as I've said, was born in 1706 in Boston. He died in 1790 in Philadelphia. When he was born to a very modest family. His father had been a tallow chandler and a candle maker and soap boiler in England, had immigrated to the new colonies in order to pursue his religious liberty. His mother was born of a Baptist missionary on the island of Nantucket. When Franklin was young, he ran away from his brother, his master in his apprenticeship. He ran away to Philadelphia in 1723, and when he arrived, he was literally penniless and sick with fever. By the time he died, he was the most extraordinary individual in all of the then United States, famous for his science, for his writing, for his political activism, for his leadership. And though he was identified with Philadelphia and with America, he lived his life throughout the world. He was born here in Boston, ran away to Philadelphia, identified himself, established his career, led much of his life there in Philadelphia, in this, the city that was designed by William Penn. You can still, in the center city, travel through these geometric pattern of streets. The center city of Philadelphia is still follows the same roads that William Penn laid out in the 17th century. Franklin identified himself with this city, but he lived his life globally. Of the last third of his life, almost all of it was spent in London and Paris. Much of his adult life was spent outside of what we think of as the United States. He was a participant in debates and arguments and engaged with people throughout the literate and Western world to try and understand what the purpose of life, what the achievements of politics could be, what is possible through human science and engineering. He wrote, starting in about 1771, he wrote a book called The Autobiography. It remains his most famous document. It is probably the most widely read autobiography in English literature. He worked on it intermittently until his death in 1790. He tells us he had a variety of motives in writing this book. This is the very first paragraph. "I have ever had a pleasure in obtaining little anecdotes of my ancestors. You remember the inquiries that we made among the remains of my relations when you were with me in England." He's writing to his son, and he tells us he, of course, did want to pass down his family narrative to his son. Well, he'd had a rough time as a representative of the colonies in dealing with Great Britain, and so he wanted to vindicate his reputation. He was honest enough to admit that it was pretty cool to write about some of the things he had done, and he wanted to indulge his vanity just a little bit. And he also said he wanted to educate others. He thought his life was fit to be imitated. What can we learn from this document? If we turn to the autobiography, if we turn to the beginning, we really need to turn to the very beginning. Glasses. Franklin learned to read. These are glasses that enabled him to read. And one of the things we know is that he learned to read at an astonishingly early age. He could not remember a time, a man of phenomenal memory. He could not remember a moment when he didn't know how to read. We estimate that he probably taught himself to read at about the age of 3. So early that he could not remember a moment without a book in his hands. And his formal education, though limited to 2 years, was supplemented by an informal education of a voracious reader. He made arrangements and deals with book printers, book lenders, friends and neighbors so that he could borrow their books, read them overnight, and return them the next morning. At his death, he left a collection of nearly 5,000 books. That is the third largest private library, the third largest library in North America in the 18th century. We don't think of Franklin as a man of the book. We think of him as something else, as something different, as the scientist, the womanizer, the chess player, the musician, the politician. But first and foremost, he was a man of the book who read and read and read voraciously. And when he read with an eye to action. He read with an eye to changing things. Whenever he read, whenever he thought, he also connected it with action. In his mind, these things were not separate. Action and reflection were two sides of the same coin. He was trying to figure out not just how to think about the world, but how to engage and act in the world. As a young man, there are two books that played a special role in his thinking. One is Daniel Defoe's An Essay Upon Projects, Schemes for Improving England. You may know Defoe from Gulliver's Travels. The same man was also a civic activist, and he wrote in England about some of the important projects that could be done, providing insurance for widows, paving streets, things that would transform English life. Cotton Mather wrote another book, Bonifacius, or An Essay Upon the Good, another book that Franklin was strongly influenced by. Mather, a Puritan Zion in the Boston of his youth, emphasized the importance of doing good in everyday life. We shouldn't miss a moment to do something to make the world a better place. Now notice that both books use this word essay in the title. To us, an essay is a short literary composition. But in Franklin's day, it had a second meaning that's no less important. An essay was an attempt, a trial, or an experiment. So to essay something was to try it out. And Franklin tried the things he read, sometimes to terrible effect, but sometimes with brilliant effect. Every time he read, he tried and experimented in his life with some of the things that he read in his books. A simple example, at the age of 16, he read a book by a man named Thomas Tryon. Tryon was an English mystic, a man who advocated a vegetarian diet as a way of spiritually purifying ourselves. The diet of Franklin's day was dominated by meat. There were few opportunities for vegetables and fruits in most of the year. A typical meal, a full meal, might include roast pork, beef, chicken, pigeon, venison, turkey, mutton, duck, partridge, you name it. If it had 2 or 4 legs, it was eaten at a meal. Tryon, this religious mystic, believed that the eating of flesh was destructive of the human spirit. We ought to, he said, show respect for all of creation. We need to purify ourselves by consuming meat that has been the fruit of an animal that was killed, by consuming meat, we are corrupting our souls. We need to change our behavior. We sometimes speak today about the power of cruelty to animals and its impact on cruelty to humans. So Tryon said in the 17th century, those who kill animals are more likely to kill people. Franklin read this as a 16-year-old boy. Remember your days as a 16-year-old, powerfully influenced by this very rich and provocative set of ideas. And what did he do? He said, Mom, Dad, guess what? I'm going to be a vegetarian. And he did. He became a vegetarian, much to their consternation, because it was a tremendous, well, it was a moral affront. The norm of society was that you do as other people do. And yet, what did he do? He said, I'm not going to eat the way you do. I want to eat without eating the meat that you all consume. It was thought odd, decidedly inconvenient, something that should not be permitted. Franklin, ever the clever lad, figured out how to cut a deal. He was his brother was his master. His brother was a printer. His brother was in charge of him. So he cut a deal. I tell you what, if you give me half as much money as you spend on my food right now, I'll cook my own meals and you'll leave me alone. Who's to resist? His brother said, sure, fine. He gave him half as much money. Benjamin managed to eat with less than half because a vegetable diet was much cheaper than a meat diet. And with the pennies left over, what do you think he did? Bought books. He loved to read. And when he read, he changed himself. Well, at the same spirit, in that same thought, in that same mode, he imagined not just spiritual purification through change in diet. Perhaps he could change his whole character. When he was 24, he undertook what he called a bold and arduous project of arriving at moral perfection. I wished to live without committing any fault at any time. I would conquer all that either natural inclination, custom, or company might lead me into. Franklin put together a list. He was always reading and collecting and taking notes. He put together a list of what are the things that he ought to do to be perfect. A set of virtues. Things like temperance and resolution, moderation, humility. Some of those virtues that you see flashing up on the building here on campus. Originally, he had 12 virtues. And he thought he was complete and he was ready to start training and start his vigil to achieve perfection. But he had a neighbor, and remember, he's living in Pennsylvania, he's living in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia was dominated by Quakers, and Quakers then as now were famous for their plain-spoken honesty. They did not believe in mincing words. And a dear neighbor of his pulled him aside and said, Ben, you are the most prideful person I have ever met in my life. And so he added a 13th virtue, which would be humility. He hadn't actually thought that that was an important virtue to have on the list, but he added that at that point. So temperance, silence, order, resolution, frugality, industry, sincerity, justice, moderation, cleanliness, tranquility, chastity, humility. These are the qualities that he thought he needed to cultivate in order to be a perfect person. The things he needed to avoid, it was quite interesting. He didn't believe in sin. He wasn't a member of the Puritan tribe. The kinds of things that constituted vices in his world, argumentativeness, idleness, and indecision. Those are the qualities of people that caused destruction and damage and hurt themselves and other people. So when Franklin was young, he read and read widely, and he came to believe that humans are malleable. You may have heard reference to this man, John Locke. He's an author of a book that played a big role in the American Revolution, a 2 treatises on government, the source of many of the ringing phrases in the Declaration of Independence about the right of a people to sue for liberty, to fight a revolution, should the government engage in a long train of abuses against their people. Locke wrote this book, but even more important, he wrote a book called An Essay Concerning Human Understanding. And it was a story, a narrative, a philosophic analysis of how humans think and understand and process the world. Locke believed that knowledge was not innate. We're not born with knowledge. Instead, we gain it through experience. You may have heard the phrase sometimes used to make sense out of this. We're born blank slates, tabula rasa. And over time, through experience, we accumulate the identities that we have, the values, the cultures, the experiences. He's a man who believes that the experiences we have make us who we are. Custom and habit are the things that make us what we are. Experience is what makes us what we are. And the liberating, the revolutionary potential there was that if there are flaws in people, they are not innate. They're not woven into nature. They are not as original sin, something that cannot be changed. The flaws that people have, the vices they have, the mistakes that they make are the function of bad education, bad experience. We are constellations of customs and habits and experiences. And if that is what made us, then a change in custom and habit and experience can change us. We can become different people. We know it in simple little ways that we have, our tastes can be changed through experience. When I was 19 and went off to college, I could not stand the taste of coffee. It was bitter, it was hot, it was just not tasty. And then midterms and final exams came around, and I found myself drinking more and more coffee. And as I drank more and more coffee, I began to think, it's not so bad. I kind of like it. And then I started to get picky. Oh, this is not as good a coffee as the other kind of coffee. I developed a taste for it. I refined that taste. The same thing happens to people with drinking of wine or beer or many other foods that have a distinctive flavor. We start off having an aversion, and through time and effort, we change and we come to like it. Well, you know, you can make the same kind of a claim, and Franklin did, about our moral lives, about the lives that we lead, not just about taste and acquired tastes, but about values. It was a wise counsel, he once wrote. It was a wise counsel given to a young man. Pitch upon that course of life which is most excellent, and custom will make it the most delightful. Act the way you want to act, and over time, you will come to, through custom and habit and experience, value it. So it's not that you first change your mind and then go and change your habits. Ironically, it's a twist. Turn it upside down. Change your habits first, and over time your mind will adapt. Your values, your passions, your tastes will be shaped. The key to a good life in this case, the key to a good life, was good habits. To develop good habits, you had to have a system. And I bet you've all seen a system like this before. This is, again, a page from the autobiography. This is what it looks like if you clean it up and turn it into a computer form. Let's call it moral bookkeeping. It does look kind of like moral bookkeeping. And you have the virtues that are listed on the side here. Temperance, silence, order, resolution, frugality. It goes on and on. These are the virtues. And then you have the days of the week. Monday, Tuesday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Franklin was trying to change his habits. He knew, for example, that he was very bad with order. His workshop was a mess. He couldn't find things in it, but he couldn't develop the habits to get himself to behave. He would beat himself on the head, and he wasn't able to get it in order. He needed a system to keep track of himself. If you've ever been on a weight loss program or an exercise program, I bet you've done the same thing. You make a chart. In this case, okay, I'm going to focus, he said, on temperance. Eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. I'm going to focus all week long on that one. And then if I violate some other, I'm going to try my best not to violate that one. And if I make a mistake and violate one of the other virtues, if I commit a vice, it's opposite. If I eat too much or if I'm disorderly, then I'll make a little check mark in the book. And he printed a little book and he would carry it around in his pocket and he'd pull it out, keep tabs. Over time, he's like, so this week I'll focus on temperance. Next week I'll focus on silence. The next week I'll focus on order. There are 13 weeks. Once I'm done, I'll start over again. This is Franklin's scheme. Over time, he imagined he would do what? Become perfect. It's a brilliant scheme. Over time, he thought that he would actually have the delightful pleasure of watching that very clean book appear. And notice even the motivation there. It's not a purity of moral motive that leads him to change his habits. It's the desire to have a clean book. It's the desire to keep the check marks down. It's the desire to do things other than what's morally righteous. It's not the motive that's key. It's the action. Sadly, he finally realized, I was surprised, he once said, I was surprised to find myself so much fuller of faults than I had imagined. You can see why humility was not one of his virtues. Some things seemed impossible, in fact. Order really gave him trouble. His workspace was a mess. And remember, he's a printer. And printers have like a million little pieces of type that are kept in little boxes and pieces of paper all over. And he's also a scientist and he's an engineer and he's engaged in all kinds of activities. And so his workshop is filled with things and they're never in the right place and he can never find them and he can never keep it in order. And there are times that he just wanted to give up. I just can't achieve it. And as always, he liked to tell a parable about that. Could you achieve perfection? He was reminded of a man who wanted the surface of his axe to shine as brightly as the edge. You know, when you sharpen an axe, the edge, the very sharp edge, is very smooth and bright, and you can see it reflecting in the light. But the broad, flat side of the blade is not particularly sharp. Well, this man wanted his whole blade to be equally shiny and bright. The blacksmith, clearly skeptical of this enterprise, said, sure, but only so long as you turn the crank on the whetstone. Okay, so he started turning the crank on the whetstone, and the man quickly became exhausted. Why? Because the blacksmith was pushing that axe right against the stone as hard as he could. It was really difficult to turn. And the man got tireder and tireder, and he finally said, I just need to stop. No, said the blacksmith. No, don't do that. Keep turning, and at some point we'll be sure and have the whole thing shiny. Yes, said the man, but I think I like a speckled axe best. Sometimes Franklin felt like that. It wasn't worth the effort. We'll take imperfection along the way. At other times he thought, I am such a silly fool. A fop would have been the word that they used in the 18th century. A fool, a dandy, somebody who was trying to be perfect, and what a silly venture it was. And then he would finally turn one more time and realize, yes, he was not perfect, but he was better than he had been. And in the process, he actually was happier with himself and more able to engage with others. Even his reason was incapable of providing solidity and direction. Reason itself is sometimes incapable of guiding us, and habit sometimes is necessary in Franklin's mind as a means to counter the malleability of reason. Another famous anecdote of his, remember Thomas Tryon, the man who said, you shall not eat flesh, the man who Franklin had learned from at the age of 16 and led him to adopting a vegetarian diet. Well, Franklin, about 3 years later, having consistently kept this vegetarian diet, was on a ship coming from Boston back to Philadelphia, and as luck would have it, his fellow passengers were fishing and caught a cod and brought it onto the boat, and then they got out a skillet and they started a fire and they put some lard in and they started to fry that fish. And poor Ben, he smelled this beautiful frying fish, and he struggled with himself because he had absorbed Tryon's lesson and had tried to live it for 3 years. The taking of every fish is a kind of murder. What have they done to us? In killing them, aren't we committing something like murder? That is what he had learned from reading Tryon. But the smell of the fish was too much. Hot out of the frying pan, he said, it smelled awfully good. I balanced some time between principle and inclination until I remembered when the fish was gutted, there were little fish in its belly. And, well, we would say what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If it was all right for the fish to eat other fish, why couldn't he eat fish? One step more. So convenient a thing is it to be a reasonable creature, since it enables one to find and make a reason for everything one has a desire to do. That is Franklin in his essence. He's skeptical of the power of reason. He's concerned about the way in which our passions mislead us, but he also has confidence that if we are slow and patient with habit, we can change ourselves. We can make ourselves into different individuals. That, I think, from a personal point of view, is what the good life is all about. From an individual's point of view, it is about transforming yourself through conscious, disciplined effort. But improvement even of this sort, it's not just a personal ideal. It also expressed Franklin's political vision, and part of what's important is to see he's not just trying to make you, for me, or anyone else, behave better. He's trying to enable us to do things that we otherwise wouldn't be able to do, because our lives together are made more profitable, more useful, more attractive, more beautiful, more exciting, more vibrant, precisely when we learn to regulate and moderate and discipline some of those errant habits and instincts that we have. In Franklin's day, almost everyone imagined that improvement of some sort was possible, but they disagreed over the possible causes. There are different things that allow us to be improved, to work with others, to collaborate and to cooperate, to lead in productive ventures. Religious figures thought that it might be love, shared belief, and religion, and value that makes it possible for us to cooperate with each other and be part of ventures in society. Politicians, Machiavellian sorts, imagined that it was fear that allowed us to behave well, to coordinate our activities, to be cooperative. Think, after all, what is it that leads you to obey the speed limit? Is it love for your fellow travelers? Fear of the police officer wailing down behind you, siren going? Well, in Franklin's day, the people who he was associated with began to think of alternatives. Could it be something more like the mutual meeting of needs and interests? Humans join together not because they love each other and not because they are fearful of each other. We join together in collective enterprises because we have needs and interests and we can be useful to each other. We exchange goods and services. We exchange ideas. We exchange values. We exchange all kinds of things. Even the word commerce itself captured this. Commerce is about the truck and barter, the sale and trade of things of value, one item for another. But commerce is also an association, the commerce between Jesus and his disciples, or the illicit commerce of the sexes. Commerce even involves ideas. A commerce of letters is a trading of letters, the exchange of anything. And why do we do this trading? Why do we engage in these activities? It is because we find it useful. Useful in the broadest sense. It makes life richer, vibrant, and more potent. But the key insight was that these things, these exchanges, these trades don't happen spontaneously. They require compromise, negotiation, and tact. Politics, economics is like society and art and every other human endeavor. It's a collaborative or a collective enterprise, according to Franklin, and it succeeds if and only if people are able to cooperate with each other, and cooperation requires that they have the ability to listen, to moderate, to compromise, to engage in a politics of give and take. The settings within which human cooperation takes place are enormous and varied. Clubs and coffee houses, theaters and assemblies, public lectures and scientific societies, newspapers, journals and books, all of these are a part of the commerce of ideas and values and people. To navigate that kind of a world, to get people to cooperate with you, to cooperate with others, it takes a very special moderation and cultivation, sociability and self-discipline. We have to be polite. Franklin believed that politeness, like many in the 18th century, was the key to improvement. Politeness not in the sense of stiff manners, but politeness in the sense of moderation, temperance, and the ability to discipline yourself and engage with others. He knew about this from personal experience. Because, let us just admit, he was not a man given to moderation. When he was a young man, reading voraciously, he was something like a teenage intellectual. He was brash, aggressive, self-satisfied, skilled at defeating people around him. He was the kind of person who could turn circles around friends and enemies alike in an argument. And when they were done, he might have won the intellectual battle, but he had lost a friend or a colleague or a compatriot because he was so aggressive, so belligerent, and so forceful. And he had to learn to moderate himself. He had to learn to temper himself in order to be able to be effective in these social settings. He tells it once again by means of an anecdote. In this case, it's an anecdote involving Cotton Mather, who was one of the great religious leaders of the Boston of his youth. And when Franklin was about 18, he was about to leave Boston, and he went to go see Mather in his home. He went up to Mather's library. Mather was, of course, this extraordinarily literate and sophisticated and forceful man. And he went up to Mather's home and in his library, and they talked, and they had a long conversation. And then Mather led him out of the house. And as they were leaving, Franklin, you know, Mather was walking out, and Franklin was turning around to the side so that he could continue to talk to Mather as he was walking. So he was walking backwards, and he didn't notice that there was a beam kind of hanging down. And as he's backing up, talking to Mather, smack, he hit his head. And you know how Puritan ministers would be in this day. They couldn't pass the opportunity to drive home a lesson. So Mather looked him square in the eye, and he said, "Stoop, Mr. Franklin, stoop, and you will miss many hard thumps in the rest of your life. You're still young. You must, and you have the world before you. Stoop as you go through it," said Mather, "and you will miss these thumps." Franklin accepted the lesson. "This advice thus beat into my head has frequently been of use to me, and I think of it when I see pride mortified and misfortune brought upon people who carry their heads too high." He taught himself over time to temper his language. "I made it a rule," he said. We're back to habituation, but it's habituation to enable him to cooperate with people who, well, sometimes he thought were idiots, but he had to cooperate with them. "I made it a rule to forbear all direct contradiction to the sentiments of others and all positive assertions of my own." He no longer would use words like "certainly" or "undoubtedly." But instead he would say things like, "You know, it seems to me," or, "If I'm not mistaken, it might be possible." "To this habit," he says, "I think it principally owing that I had early so much weight with my fellow citizens when I proposed new institutions or alterations in the old, and so much influence in public councils when I became a member. That is to say, a library company, a volunteer fire department, a charity hospital serving the poor of Philadelphia, perhaps even a revolutionary movement, were successful in Franklin's mind. His role was successful, not just because of the cleverness of his ideas or the wisdom and insight that he brought, but because he understood how to relate to people, to talk to them, to persuade them, because he had learned to moderate his own passions, his own temper through habituation." Some quick examples of how this happens. The Library Company of Philadelphia, a classic kind of a story. Franklin and his friends were all young traders, young businessmen, young craftsmen, printers, scriveners, shoemakers, leather tanners. They were, like him, incredibly interested in learning and growth and development, and like him, when he is a young man in his early 20s, they were poor. They couldn't afford very many books. So what did they do? Franklin said, "Let's take all of our books and put them together. We'll share. Won't that be nice?" So they took all of their books and they put them in a room and they left them there in a common library. It turned out they didn't have as many books as they thought. Worse yet, over time, the few books they had disappeared. People mistreated them, and there was no way of knowing who had torn the book or damaged it or dropped it in the water. The books were not well taken care of. Some of them disappeared. The library wasn't that big of a collection. After a year, everybody was sick and disgusted, and they said, "Forget it. This voluntary cooperation thing doesn't work. We're taking our books home," and the library disappeared. Franklin realized that that was not in anyone's interest, that it undermined their ability to work together to create something stronger than what they individually were capable of. So he formed the Library Company of Philadelphia. 50 subscribers agreed to annual contributions for 50 years. They drew lists of books. They sent their lists over to Europe, where individuals would purchase the books and send them back to them. This is actually the collection box that they had for book suggestions. It's just like libraries today. Gentlemen, are requested to deposit in the lion's mouth the titles of such books as they may wish to have imported. Collected lists of books, ordered them, had them delivered. They even hired a librarian to keep tabs over those books. They had to come to terms with some of the problems, and it's really interesting. You read the minutes of the library company. I have new sympathy for Brian Schottlander. The problems we have with libraries are endemic. This is the first public library in North America, and the very first page, they had to deal with people who returned books late and brought them back damaged. What are you going to do about these people? Well, first, you get them to contribute, and so they sign a piece of paper, and they join a joint stock company, and then you have circulation slips, just like we have for so many years until computers replaced the pieces of paper, where you would agree to take the book, and if you didn't return it on time or in good condition, you'd have to pay a fine, and there was a librarian to keep track of all of it. Because we know, as Franklin knew, that readers are the biggest danger to books possible. You have to do something to protect the books from you and me. This kind of collaboration and cooperation was the kind that Franklin relished in. It created a library. The library's example was emulated by other towns, other groups within Philadelphia, other places throughout the colonies. Soon, people found new opportunities to read. He modestly said that from their having no public amusements to divert their attention. They didn't have the internet. Having no public amusements to divert their attention from study, they became better acquainted with books, and in a few years were observed by strangers, people throughout North America, to be better instructed and more intelligent than people of the same rank generally are in other countries. You could feel his pride in that, a righteous pride. The Library Company of Philadelphia still exists. I have sat in its stacks and read books there. It is an extraordinary institution, but it was made possible by cooperation, and cooperation that rested on the ability to persuade people to join together in a shared enterprise. Now, sometimes we try and persuade people in situations where their interests are in sharp conflict with each other. I want to mention one such example in something called the Association, which doesn't sound very exciting. It sounds rather bland and neutral, but it turned out to be the first volunteer militia, almost a private army in North America, that Franklin formed in 1747 in order to defend the colony of Pennsylvania. In 1747, there were rumors that pirates were going to be coming up the Delaware River, and in coming up the Delaware River, they were going to assault Philadelphia and steal and rob and destroy. Spanish pirates. Colonists were nervous. They were anxious. But remember, Philadelphia was a Quaker colony, and one of the principles of Quakers since the early 1660s was nonviolence. The Quaker assembly refused to arm and protect the city of Philadelphia because that would have been a violation of their strictures against the use of martial force. So the government wasn't much help. Quakers were immune to fear. Remember, how do you mobilize people? Fear didn't work. Franklin tried to appeal, because he was a leader of tremendous power. He and his cohort tried to appeal to the rich in town, the rich merchants in town, the proprietary party, people who were associated with the proprietor equivalent to like the governor of the colony, would they be willing to help out? They were not Quakers, they were Anglicans. They were fabulously wealthy, and they were consumed by spite because the Quakers held political power, and they would do nothing to help protect the colony if in so doing it would help the Quakers. And so the rich, the truly rich and potent, the people with the capacity to protect the colonies, refused to help out. Franklin, in desperation, did the only thing left possible. He appealed to the middling sort, to ordinary individuals, farmers, shopkeepers, tradesmen. If no one else is going to defend them, they would have to defend themselves. And he began to organize them into a voluntary militia. The rich, they can shift for themselves. Quite literally, they can pack up their belongings and flee the city and not suffer terribly. The Quakers have made clear from their values that they will not be moved by fear to act contrary to their religious beliefs. Farmers, shopkeepers, tradesmen, they will be destroyed in the city if they have no means of protecting themselves. Their vulnerability was a source of solidarity. This was the key, to persuade people that what they share, needs and interests, take many forms. And in this case, the need and interest they had was in protection, because these individuals, perhaps 60 to 70% of the population, had no other means of protecting themselves. They were all vulnerable to assault, and they had to work together. But this is a tremendous political challenge. They had to be persuaded that they could and should protect themselves. They had to be persuaded that they could do something. Passivity, resignation, fatalism, these are tremendous obstacles. The fear that you can't do anything is an obstacle. And so Franklin had to engage in a publicity campaign. Among other things, he was a brilliant polemicist. He was a brilliant manipulator of public opinion. So one of the things he did was to print a cartoon as a prelude to a book announcing the self-help efforts of the middling people of Philadelphia. It was a recycled image. It had come from a school textbook. It was an Aesop's fable. He made a few changes that originally, in the original school book, that was supposed to be God up in the corner. But Franklin wanted it to be Hercules. So he added scratched in a club so that it would look like Hercules. And he played on this image and told a story to go along with it. It's about a farmer whose wagon is stuck in the mud and he can't get his wagon out. And he pleads and begs for Hercules to reach down and help him and pull his wagon out of the mud. And Hercules says, "You fool. Whip the horses and set your shoulder to the wheels. Then call on Hercules and he will help." The moral, said Franklin, was clear. Lazy wishes never do men service. But if they would help from God in the time of need, let him not only implore God's assistance, but make use of his own best efforts. Help yourself. Work hard, says Franklin. Struggle against fate, and that will allow you to defend yourself. And sure enough, he did get 10,000 Pennsylvanians to join this extraordinary self-governing association. Now, one quick final thought about the association. Of course, they're trying to protect a city against pirates and ships, and, you know, men with muskets and swords are not going to be able to do much against a ship. They needed cannons. They needed to build a fort. They needed something big and powerful. They could build a fort. Ordinary men with horses and wagons could fell trees and build forts. But the cannons, now that was a real challenge. How do you get people to purchase cannons? No ordinary individual had sufficient money to do it. How do we persuade people to cooperate in a venture like that? What do you think he did? He sold lottery tickets. They needed 18 cannons to protect the city. No individual had the resource to do it. There was no effective bond market. There was no way to raise this capital through any effective fiscal means except selling tickets. And they raised enough money to buy 18 cannons. Now think about this once again. Motives are not relevant. The first question is not, are you doing this for the right reasons? The first question is, are you greedy enough to want to win the lottery? Will you buy a ticket? Greed, the desire for success, leads people to join in enterprises that they might not otherwise do. So there's a clever mix of motives. One of the things that's characteristic of Franklin, unlike many in his puritanical environment, he never asked that people have pure, simple, clear, direct motives. It's always about behavior. It's always about conduct, even in his own life. And I want to end with a final story about politics and cooperation and change, because it's not just a matter of Franklin changing other people, of engaging other people to engage in socially productive and virtuous activity. So we're asking, what is it to improve life? It is to transform yourself. It is to enable your friends and countrymen to protect themselves. It is to create libraries where conversation and learning are possible. Sometimes Franklin's final act, it involved bringing freedom to people who had been enslaved. We have to start, of course, with this extraordinary American paradox, one that's familiar to anyone who has studied American history. To take a specific example, in 1776, the Continental Congress authorized a Declaration of Independence to be written motivating and justifying independence by the colonies. They asked Thomas Jefferson to write the first draft. Jefferson then turned to a fellow member of the committee, Benjamin Franklin, and said, "Ben, I need you to be my editor. Will you look this over and revise and adjust the language?" And Franklin did so. This is in June of 1776. He did so. The most famous change that he made in Jefferson's original prose, the phrase was, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." Franklin, ever efficient, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." It's really much more beautiful. It's just stunning. Left standing was the subordinate clause that all men are created equal. Franklin made these changes while sitting in his home on Market Street in Philadelphia, a home that was owned by his daughter. He lived there with his daughter and her husband and their two children and a slave named George, a slave he had purchased in the 1760s. Samuel Johnson said, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes?" And sure enough, the hypocrisy is there, and it is thick and strong. Franklin, no different than anyone else. He had lived most of his life, like all in North America, had lived almost all of his life in the context of slavery. As a boy in Boston, he would have seen slaves bought and sold by people living in his father's home. As a printer in Philadelphia, he printed advertisements for slaves. He printed advertisements for the return of runaway slaves. At any point between 1735 and 1781, we estimate he owned between 1 and 3 slaves. And yet, he was susceptible to change. In 1757, a leader of a London religious society, in association with a missionary impulse, the Associates of Dr. Bray, came to Franklin in London and asked, "What is the best scheme for creating a school for black children in Philadelphia?" Charitable societies were instruments through which education was brought, especially in some cases Anglican, in many cases Quaker charitable societies, providing the earliest schools. And in fact, this individual working with Franklin helped to create the first successful school for black children in North America. Franklin was not there when it was founded, but in 1763 he traveled back, came back to Philadelphia, and he went and visited the school and observed the children. He was there as a auditor, as someone to check in and see how his work had proceeded. He admits, I conceived a higher opinion of the natural capacities of the black race than I had ever before entertained. Their apprehension seems as quick, their memory as strong, their readiness to receive instruction in every respect equal to that of the white children. This is a landmark. He realized there was no difference between the young black children and the young white children, though the individuals living in Philadelphia refused to allow them to be a part of the same school. He was confounded. He even wrote, I don't know why I was so prejudiced in the past. And in true Franklin fashion, having noticed that he was prejudiced, he then set it aside and moved forward. The man did not ruminate. He never reflected. He never thought about the past. He said, now that I come to understand how equality is possible, what can I do to make it possible? How can I enable the movement towards freedom? And he began cooperating with abolitionists in England and America, attempting to bring an end to the slave trade and to slavery. When slavery within England was eliminated in 1772, the British were coy. They ended slavery within the territory of Great Britain, but they did nothing to disrupt the slave trade itself. Franklin wrote in public, "Can sweetening our tea with sugar be a circumstance of such absolute necessity? Can the petty pleasures thence arising to the taste compensate for so much misery produced among our fellow creatures, and such a constant butchery of the human species by this pestilential, detestable traffic in the bodies and souls of men?" This is not a man who still believes there to be a fundamental difference between individuals, though he has not yet fully come to support abolition. As with many of his generation and age, change came slowly through experience with associations, experience with the abolitionist movement's experience with religious associations, experience with educational institutions. That is to say, just as Franklin imagined collective enterprise transforming others, so he too is transformed by his engagement in collective enterprise. And when he returned to the United States in the 1780s, he was elected first president of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. They litigated on behalf of blacks who had been illegally enslaved. They worked to improve the living conditions of free blacks in the North. They sought to mobilize international support for the end of the international slave trade. One of his friends, Josiah Wedgwood, you may know that name from the pottery. Josiah Wedgwood was also the grandfather of Charles Darwin. He was a scientific friend of Benjamin Franklin's, and the Wedgwood family were ardent abolitionists, deeply opposed to the slave trade. Josiah Wedgwood, friend of Franklin's, created a series of cameos. These are small. They're about an inch and a half tall. And he boxed them up and sent them off to Franklin in Philadelphia. And Franklin then passed them out among his friends, just as we would wear buttons calling for an end to apartheid or an end to some other horrific international practice. So women wore them in their hats, men on their jackets, all over. People decorated things with this image. Am I not a man and a brother? Became one of the most enduring images of the abolitionist movement at this time. Franklin's final act, public act, involved an attempt to put in practice this new idea that he had come to understand as a result of his life experiences, as a result of his engagement with other people. In 1790, in February, the Society for the Abolition of Slavery submitted a petition over Franklin's name to Congress calling for the abolition of slavery. This was the first and last time that on the floor of the House of Congress an anti-slavery petition was received and debated. Southern representatives rebelled. They literally threatened civil war. James Madison, soon to become president of the United States, worked carefully to ensure that this would never happen again, and it was Madison's diplomatic and political genius to ensure that no future anti-slave or abolitionist petitions came to the House of the floor. Franklin, of course, was not a politician. He was a private citizen at this point, a leader of the abolitionist society. So he responded the only way he could in print with a scathing satire of all of the shibboleths of slavery. In this case, by pretending to be a document written by a Barbary pirate justifying the enslavement of Christians. And every justification for the slavery of blacks by American slave owners was used by this Barbary pirate to justify the enslavement of Christians. It was a tremendous hoax, clear in its purpose, satiric, biting. 3 weeks later, Franklin passed. So what is a good life? Well, a good life is a life of improvement. We can change ourselves, and we can change our world. And as Pollyanna-ish as that sounds, it's not easy, but it is possible. This was Franklin's message in his autobiography. He had changed himself. He had learned to moderate his teenage brash tendencies so that he could actually talk to people and persuade them, and he had learned to become a better person in the process. The good life is a life of constant revision. Improvement requires flexibility, the ability to learn and grow and change. Every life, every doctrine, every idea is marred by errata. This is a term that printers use to talk about mistakes. Everything we do is filled with mistakes. All we can do is correct the mistakes. That's what a printer does. They don't weep, they don't cry, they just correct the mistakes. So he wrote his own epitaph. It's brilliant. The body of Ben Franklin, printer. Like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But the work shall not be wholly lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more perfect edition, corrected and amended by the author. The good life is a life of constant revision and improvement. The good life is a life of improvement of self and others through discipline, through effort, through hard work, indeed through the investment of time. Joining with others will strengthen and improve the world. Sometimes even small things can have tremendous impact. One of Franklin's most extraordinary contributions, and most silly at the same time, was to have the streets of Philadelphia paved and swept. If you've been to Philadelphia, you know in the summer it's beastly and hot, in the winter it's cold and ugly, and in between it rains all the time. And those nicely laid out streets, that rectangular grid, they were mud streets in Franklin's day, even in the center of the city. And when the rains came and then the frost came, the mud and the ice, and it was difficult and painful. And so one of the things Franklin did, one of his civic enterprises, was to persuade his neighbors to chip in and to pave the streets. And then after they had done that, they realized mud still got up onto the pavement. And once it dried out, it blew into the eyes of people, and it caused a great deal of difficulty and pain and quagmires when they're wet and dusty when they're dry. And so he persuaded his neighbors one more time, not just to pay to pave the streets, but to hire a young worker to sweep the streets and keep them clean, to keep the dust down. Conscious, of course, Franklin, in his autobiography, conscious that this seems unimportant. But he says, add up the individuals affected. Add up the consequences for life, and it seems not so small. Human felicity is produced not so much by great pieces of good fortune that seldom happen, but by little advantages that occur every day. Human happiness, the good life, is not a function of large, spectacular, and rare events. It is the small, the slow, the everyday, the things that we change in ourselves and in the world around us through small, slow effort and industry. That's where real human happiness lies. That poster that we have for this series, designed by a skilled graphic designer on his own, tried to figure out what the good life might be and how to represent it. And if you're a scholar or if you've read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, you might recognize that it's a sparrow flying from the sun or flying past the sun. And Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics once said, as a single sparrow does not make a summer, so a single good day does not make a good life. I think that's the message that Franklin shares as well. It's not a single day, a single moment, a single experience, but instead a long considered pattern. So, to end, my absolute favorite picture of Benjamin Franklin. Why? Imagine you ask him, what do we do about one of the problems we have today? You name it, there are a bunch of them: global climate change, depopulation, civic inequality, all things that he encountered in his own day. What would he do if you ask him, Ben, what do you think we should do? Well, you know, his first reaction would be to claim no special expertise, inwardly glowing, knowing that he had some good answers. I love this picture because there is an intensity of energy and focus. He's now sitting, this is in Paris in 1781, he's sitting outside the office of the Minister of Foreign Affairs. His goal is to persuade him to support the American Revolutionary cause by providing money to buy weapons for the colonies or for the new United States. He's sitting there, calm, focused, but you can see the ideas are just buzzing through his head. He always had ideas. He was always thinking, always probing, always imagining. But if you ask him, what should we do? He would not say, you should do this. He would say, let's get together a committee. Let's create an association. Let's talk about it. Let's share ideas and see what we can come up with collectively. A society for mutual improvement. That was his way, not to try and dictate, but instead to generate. This goes back to the idea of needs and interests, binding people together through conversation and engagement to find some solution. What is a good life? It is a good life spent focused on improvement, on individual industry and cooperative effort. Two final phrases from Franklin. They say the same thing. One of them is rather crude, the other less so. The crude one is, he that lives upon hope dies farting. He had a rather crude sense of humor that came out at times. And then at other times he could try and emulate people like Shakespeare. So this is the alternative version. Dost thou love life? Then do not squander time, for that's the stuff life is made of. The good life is a life in which we use our time wisely. Time is like money. Use it wisely. Don't waste it. Don't squander it. Use it efficiently. Use it to improve yourself and to improve others around us. That is the message that Franklin tried to communicate through his autobiography and through his life. And I thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about it. If you would like to argue about something, tell me I'm wrong. Provide a counterexample or ask a question. There is a microphone sitting up here. I would be delighted to field any questions if you had any.
I read John Adams by McCollum, and he paints a very different picture, I thought, of Franklin, especially in Paris, of someone very personally indulgent and lazy and fat and idle.
So here's the story. Adams is the kind of guy who got up at 5 in the morning. Franklin in Paris liked to get up about 9:30 or 10. Adams was a relative teetotaler. Franklin enjoyed... But there's more to it than that. And it's not just about personal. Adams was a believer in what we scholars would call the classical Republican dogma. This doctrine that you should behave like a Roman centurion, a Roman official, and you should be as blunt and honest and forceful as possible. Franklin is totally not of that ilk. His whole life was spent trying to repudiate that idea. So when Adams arrived in Paris, Franklin was there first, and then Adams arrived, and he was sent, and he thought it his mission to accomplish as quickly as possible. So again, this is a diplomatic challenge. How do you persuade the King of France to give you money so that you can fight a war against the King of England, who's sitting very close? Adams thought that the way you did that was to point your finger at the King of France and say, "You must give us money." Franklin thought that the way you did that was, well, in Paris, behave like the Parisians. He engaged in society. He talked to people. He gently persuaded them. He reminded them of some shared cultural traits, of shared values and ideas. Within 2 years of Adams' arrival in Paris, the French Minister of Foreign Affairs, Vergennes, decreed that Adams would no longer be allowed to enter the royal court. Franklin extracted more money from the French than the French ought to have given. In some respects, the French Revolution that occurred in 1789 was precipitated by excessive lending by the French to the new United States. The best historian of this period has simply and directly said, Gordon Wood has simply and directly said, that without Franklin's skill at extracting money from the French, that the entire revolutionary effort would have been for naught, that the colonies or the new nation would have been defeated. So in that sense, Adams didn't like him, but judge by the effects. And the effects were Franklin knew how to work a crowd and how to persuade and how to engage, and all those skills that he developed in the assembly and in other places in Pennsylvania he could use. So I think it is a deep division, a deep difference and disagreement. Franklin believed we always have to moderate ourselves. Adams always thought you should be blunt and direct. And between those two, at some level, choices have to be made, and Franklin made his. And we're fortunate that he did, actually. Yeah. Sure.
After the codfish incident, did Ben get back to his vegetarian ways?
Yeah, you know, occasionally here and there, not consistently. Not consistently, and truthfully, when he was young, they never ate very well when he was growing up. That is, it wasn't fancy food. It was utilitarian eating. And if you've ever been to, like, meetings and conferences and things like that, you know what rubber chicken is like, right? And he actually reports that it was a good thing that he was raised on a very simple and unfancy diet, because it made it easy for him as a politician to travel over the colonies, and wherever he went, whatever they fed, he was happy to eat it. And so he was kind of a go-along, get-along when it came to food, and he set aside his particular passion for vegetarianism. But the influence of Tryon comes back repeatedly in the anti-slavery logic. And so Tryon, this 17th century mystic, was himself one of the early anti-slavery advocates. In addition to supporting vegetarianism, he was an abolitionist. He opposed the slave trade. And that kind of sensibility and sensitivity did persist. And you can see it resonating, and at some point it starts to click. Oh, just as I ought not to have slaughtered animals, I ought not to slaughter humans. And there is that resonance very clearly, and it does continue in that way. Yeah, absolutely.
Should we take one more?
One more question? Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thank you for a beautiful talk. I'm a fan of yours, have your books, and follow what you write about Ben Franklin, and have been a fan of Ben Franklin. I was curious as to some of his thoughts and his uniqueness of thoughts. In particular, and have they stood the test of time? And so in particular, I'll ask you if his thoughts on population was equivalent to prosperity that you write about in your book.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to think of the short answer as opposed to the long answer. And so one of the things that Franklin did, he lived at a time when population density was low. The most dense regions in North America during his lifetime probably had about 100 people per square mile. San Diego County, San Diego metropolitan area, has about 4,000 people per square mile. So it's a very low density. North America at the time of the Revolution had about 2.5 million people. They did believe that there was a relationship between the resource base and between the population. And he was an imperialist. He believed that there was a possibility of extending. There is beauty, he thought, in growth and expansion and in growing the people across North America. And so he looked forward to, and he saw, as many in his day did, this tremendous expanse of land that was capable of supporting a huge population. So he wrote in 1751, he published a book, an essay that was on population. And his essay laid out a logic that related the population to the means of subsistence. And every region has a certain means of subsistence. And if you're an agricultural economy, there's a certain population you could support on a piece of land. If you've converted to an industrial economy or a mechanical economy, then you can support a higher population because the productivity of the land is different. So there's a relationship between means of reproduction, means of subsistence, and the population that you can carry. He unquestioningly believed that growth was a good thing. So would he have been able to make sense out of the possibility of overpopulation? Didn't cross his mind. He didn't think about that at all. How would he have responded? It would, the analytic tools that we use to make sense out of population growth do, intriguingly, track back to Franklin's arguments. Remember what I just said. Population, means of subsistence. And he thought that the population in North America would double every 25 years. Who was one of his friends in England? Wedgwood. Who was Wedgwood's son, or a relative son? Erasmus Darwin. Who was Erasmus Darwin's son? Robert Darwin. Who was Robert Darwin's son? Charles Darwin. When Charles Darwin came to write The Origin of the Species, actually, there was a 19-year period. He had developed his ideas on the beagle in his journals, in reflecting back when he got back to London. And when he came to developing his ideas, the key was the relationship between means of subsistence and population. It's the mechanism, right, that provides for natural selection. And the mechanism of natural selection, the books that Darwin was reading at that moment, literally begin with reference to an invocation of Franklin's essays on population growth. So would he have understood and appreciated population overgrowth? No. And if you've been to Philadelphia lately, they're not so happy with population decline either. Philadelphia, Detroit, most of the UK suffers from population decline. And so there is this relationship. But what are the tools that we would use? He's got some of the tools. He helped to lay the groundwork, means of subsistence, level of population, and then you can think about the possibility of changing the means of subsistence through agricultural revolution, through alternative forms of so forth. So I don't have a good answer for it. He would form an association. He would get together with friends. He would have people argue about it. And of course, he was a brilliant scientist who started the first philosophic society, scientific society in North America, the American Philosophic Society, but they don't mean philosophy, they mean science. This is the American Scientific Society, and it remains a vibrant force in American letters. He'd call on those people to get together and figure this thing out. So that, I think, is the right answer. But he's got some of the tools that allow us to begin to understand why population growth happens, why it declines, what we can do to try and change and transform it. That was not a short answer, was it? I don't give short answers. Sorry.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.